Welcome to the Voice of Advocacy. I'm your host, Dr. Brick Lance. Tim Keller once commented on the cultural elites. He describes them as those that have the most influence in our culture with the power of words, including written and spoken, in areas such as education, entertainment, and the media. So I want to welcome two journalists, they're very gifted journalists, by the way, and whose interest in writing overlaps significantly with CMDA's advocacy department. So the power of their words, I would say, make them our cultural elites. I mean that in a very good way. So Leah Savas and Steve West, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Bert.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So let me ask you about the four key vulnerable groups that concerns CMDA and what trends you may be sensing at this point in time. So let me ask them one at a time. I want to talk about gender dysphoria and the care, and I put care in quotation mark, that distorts their God-given gender. So we're witnessing all kinds of complications. We now have detransitioners, and there's significant damage being done to individuals as well as our culture in general. Do either of you have a sense of where this is going in our culture?
I'll talk a little bit about it. It's not an area that I report on a whole lot. We have someone that covers that area, but I followed it quite a bit, and I did an article a couple of years ago in the magazine about what was happening legally in terms of gender dysphoria, gender claims, you know. And what I was reporting on back then was a number of lawsuits that had been brought for medical malpractice by detransitioners who were suing like Kaiser Permanente and other organizations and doctors for what they went through, a violation of standard of care, lack of informed consent because they were young when they agreed to these procedures. And so I used to say back at that time, I used to say, well, maybe we're on the cusp of something changing. Maybe it'll change as a result of the lawsuits. Maybe once some of these lawsuits are won, the insurance companies will get antsy about covering these kind of procedures. And that'll be the beginning of the end legally for these kinds of things. And that's certainly helped. But those lawsuits continue to wind their way through the system. And I think the thing that's happened culturally, and certainly this administration has helped as well, is that this has become something that is so against the nature, the idea that you can be the gender you think you want to be, that it just confronts reality. And for many people, it just doesn't make any sense. And so I think this is something that we have sort of crested the hill on to some extent. And how far we go back down toward normality, I'm not sure, but this is something that may be able to change. We may be able to view this as something that is a mental illness that needs to be treated with psychotherapy, counseling, and not through attempts to alter the body in some way.
Leah, any comments on this area?
Yeah, so this is not in my wheelhouse, so I have not followed very closely, but just from what I've seen, it's been interesting hearing other reports on like what's going on in the UK, how they're a few steps ahead of us in this whole saga. And my understanding, and I mean, like I said, I'm not like the expert in this, but my understanding is they're kind of on the other side. They're starting to come out of this, I guess, just confusion. And that, I guess that's the only word I can really think of how to call it. But, you know, the UK Supreme Court just recently ruled that the definition of a woman is woman, like the word woman is based on biology, which is a real victory there for people who have been opposing that gender ideology. So to see that happen, it's really encouraging. And hopefully we can get there ourselves in a few years.
Well, encourage your colleagues to continue writing on this topic. But let's go to your wheelhouse, Leah. So let's talk about the beginning of life. Of course, in the United States, we're losing over 1 million babies per year. And as you very well know, the chemical abortion has now overtaken surgical abortion, somewhere between probably 60 to 70% of abortions with a chemical drug. But, you know, it's not only losing babies, but mothers are suffering. We had a new release come out last week about the harms to mothers, which is nearly 1 out of 9 with a severe complication. I would make the claim, though, take it even further, This is damaging families and the family structure, which then damages communities because families are the structure within a community. It's also damaging men. So it's distorting what a man is supposed to be. And I always quote the statistic that if men would be men, we would cut abortion in half in this country. I know you also write about in vitro fertilization. In fact, Tennessee just this last week passed a bill making in vitro fertilization a right. Now, for our listeners, Leah Savas wrote a beautiful World article on April 15th on IVF. It's probably one of the best written articles I've seen. So anyway, I would encourage you to go back and look at that. But where do you sense the tide going, Leah? And then we'll go to Steve after you.
Well, I guess I'll start with IVF. It really just has come into the spotlight for a lot of people in the past maybe year and 2 months, you know, ever since the Alabama Supreme Court issued a ruling stating that embryonic humans could be considered children in the state's Wrongful Death of a Minor Act. So if a, you know, if an embryo is destroyed after being taken out of a freezer, that the parents can sue for that child's death. And that just sparked a lot of backlash. The IVF clinics, a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them in the state said, we can't continue to operate if this is going to be how the state views children or embryonic children. So the reaction has largely been to say, no, we love IVF. IVF is great because it builds families. We need to make sure it's protected. And in a lot of ways, lawmakers have brushed over some of the big ethical questions about IVF, like even seeing Georgia and Tennessee pass these very pro-IVF laws. The conversations have been large, like any opposition that I've noticed has been focused mainly on, well, we don't want genetic testing of embryos. We don't want just willy-nilly discarding unused embryos, which those are really important questions. And obviously, though, they're not getting, at least among lawmakers, the attention or the care that those questions need. A lot of lawmakers are like, you know, well, what? You don't want IVF to happen? Because this is how IVF functions. There's just built into the system a lot of discarding of unwanted embryos or indefinite freezing of unused embryos. But a lot of the questions that aren't being asked is what even goes on in the IVF process? And so just digging into the differences between the development in utero versus the development in a petri dish in a lab for an embryonic human, what are those differences? What even does it mean to start your life in a lab? And these are questions that I think are really important, but people just in general aren't asking them. So I do see the tide going towards a very pro-IVF country, state by state, even conservative states. I really think in general, no one wants to say that IVF is a bad idea. They don't even want to ask the question, maybe is it a bad idea? So, you know, I think there are some voices that are trying to lead people to pause and at least consider, well, is there a more ethical way to do IVF? But I don't think that's the mainstream voice. And unfortunately, yeah, like for the abortion issue, I would almost say that I don't see it becoming any less common than it has been in the past. I think as long as families are so dysfunctional as they are now, like the family unit just doesn't have the priority that it used to have in early America. And as a result, we're going to have a lot of these unplanned pregnancies, this focus on being an autonomous individual, making my own decisions, doing what is best for myself. Like that's just natural human selfishness. And I can tell you, just having my own child now, it really does challenge your pride and your selfishness when you have a child to care for 24/7. And I think people are resisting. They're kind of resisting being forced into that sort of situation. So in that sense, I think abortion overall, I don't see it becoming any less common because it's a heart issue. It's not first and foremost a legislative issue. Like, even though all these states have protections for unborn babies, you know, women can still go online and order them from another, order abortion pills from a doctor in another state. And that sense that, oh, I need to have an abortion isn't going to go away until that woman recognizes who she actually is as an image bearer, who her child actually is as an image bearer of God. So, not to be pessimistic, I do tend to be pessimistic. So maybe Steve has other thoughts on that. But
no, I appreciate that. And just for your interest, CMDA just passed a new ethical statement on IVF last week, so an updated version. So we're deeply involved in both of those issues. Yeah, Steve. So since Dobbs, you know, I don't know, was it seven states that have passed an amendment or some kind of legislation protecting abortion rights? Are more states going to do this? What do you think?
You know, it's not my area again to talk about, but I think that we'll see us, you know, we see a divide among states on that particular issue. And so, yeah, probably so. It's difficult, like Leah said, with the families being as dysfunctional as they are and the primacy of the individual and individual autonomy, to imagine things changing significantly as long as people are, you know, feeling like they got to do what's best for themselves. But, you know, a lot of this has to do with marriage formation. You don't have strong and healthy marriages, then you have unplanned pregnancies, you have abortion, you have children being raised in a single parent family with its own difficulties. And so some of this is setting forth a positive vision of what marriage is. And that requires some work on the part of the church to do that and make that case. And I think that can be done. But, you know, we for so long were fighting for life, we would say, but culturally viewed as against abortion, as against something. Well, what are we for? We're for life. We're for marriage. We're for family formation. And then there's this concern about the lack of births, the population decline. And so you have a lot of pronatalist people out there who, you know, are supportive of IVF, because they want, you know, more children to be born, because our economy will suffer or other things will happen if we don't have workers. And so all of that kind of factors into it as well. And for me, you know, IVF and the abortion, but these things are sort of out of sight, out of mind for people. They can't really see that embryo when they take a pill for an abortion. They can't really see what's happening. They don't, there's not a child there in their mind. They can't think about that. And so I think that makes it really difficult for folks. And isn't such an, in their mind, such an easy thing to do. Of course, we know it's not that easy for women to do this, but they believe that it is oftentimes. And so that's the problem. I might mention too, that these embryos, there's such a dangerous tendency now to treat this as property. So here's a human life being treated as property legally. And that has all kinds of bad ramifications. And so we haven't even begun to
see. We saw that about 150 years ago, didn't we?
Right. So yeah, we treated human beings as, you know, as property. And so back then, as slaves. And so now we're having to wrestle with it, get this again. So we haven't even begun to deal with all the ethical and legal issues that this is going to bring about. And, you know, this administration, for what good it has done, is supportive of IVF. And so you have to think about that, and supportive of allowing the abortion pill to be out there. So I don't see any relief for that, you know, in the next 4 years.
All right. Let's go to the other end of life. And this is a battle that CMDA is involved in every legislative session. And that's physician-assisted suicide. We have 10 jurisdictions that is legal, and Delaware is about to make theirs legal. Oregon is trying to take away, it's still in committee right now, take away all the safeguards. New York, Illinois, Connecticut is there every year with this legislation. Steve, where do you see this going in the future as far as assisted? So are we going to become like Canada?
I'm a little pessimistic about this too, Leah might be too, but I don't see this trend changing anytime soon for us, because people, as long as people view this as a merciful thing, something that can relieve pain and suffering something that should be a person's choice to do, and something that, frankly, they may want to be able to do at some point, then we continue down that juggernaut of allowing it. And I think only when we begin to see, and we have seen some of the problems, for example, in Canada's system already, but only when this becomes a focus, like the transgender issue has become a focus, only when this happens will we maybe see some change in that regard. I'm short-term pessimistic, long-term maybe not, because, I mean, things can change long-term. You know, like you look back in history, you look at slavery and how that changed. We're in a situation now where we have legalized gambling in so many states and lotteries, but back in the, I don't know how long, the turn of the century, the 19th century, whatever, there were lots of these kinds of lotteries and gambling, and they saw the excesses of it, and a lot of states curbed a lot of this activity once they saw what happened. Of course, you know, it happens again when people have short-term memories, and so this kind of thing comes up again. Vice returns, and sometimes we have to see some of the ill effects of that before we actually are willing to do something about it.
Leah, any comments on end of life?
I think it was the New York General Assembly, the State Assembly, instead of, not the Senate, I think it was the Assembly.
That's correct.
Just last week or 2 weeks ago?
That was last week, I believe, yes.
Yeah, they passed a bill to legalize assisted suicide. And that's the first time that it had passed, I think, either chamber. And they've been presenting this legislation since, I think it was 2016. So, you know, they've been at this a while. And finally, they've had some momentum. It's not clear what's going to happen to the bill in the Senate or even what the governor thinks of it. But to see that momentum for them is discouraging from our perspective as pro-lifers. And from the flip side, I was writing about Montana earlier this year. They're the only jurisdiction in the United States that has technically legal assisted suicide, but it's not in law. It's just because of a state Supreme Court ruling. So some lawmakers have been trying to close the loophole that the state Supreme Court made in that ruling pretty much ever since it first came down, which I want to say it was over two decades ago. And so far have not been successful. So yeah, here we are. I shouldn't have said over two decades ago. I think it was less than that. But, you know, they've been working at this. And again, this year, they were unsuccessful at closing that legal loophole, which is not, I was hopeful. It seemed like maybe they had momentum. But it's discouraging to see that, because while more states are legalizing this, a state that's trying to rein things in is not having success. So yeah, I would say I'm also pessimistic about it, but it's also just looking at the country or the world as a whole. Almost all of Australia has legalized assisted suicide. You have Canada, you have the UK discussing this, and I don't know what's going to happen there, but it does seem like they, just each country that is considering this kind of legislation, there's just more and more momentum for assisted suicide instead of for more life-affirming options. And I think it goes back to the selfishness, the, you know, I want to be able to decide what I'm going to do with my life, just kind of a failure to acknowledge God's sovereignty and control. They're very closely intertwined, all of these issues. It's just a matter of, are we going to submit to our sovereign God, or do we want to try to take charge of things ourselves? And a lot of messes come when we try to take charge of things ourselves. So,
all right, let's go to our fourth bucket of vulnerable populations, kind of in Steve's alley here, but that's the conscience protections. Now, even though the Alliance of Hippocratic Medicine lost at SCOTUS last year on the mifepristone ruling, they did firmly affirm our bill to practice according to our conscience. And a few states have actually passed conscience freedom bills. I will tell you, the state of Oregon, one of our Christian House members tried to get a committee to hear a very similar conscience bill, and no one would hear it. They couldn't even get it to committee. Steve, what's your thinking on conscience protections for us as healthcare professionals?
Yeah, I'm pretty hopeful about that a number of states will enact those kind of conscience protections. And, I think this administration is supportive of that as well. So I do think, and, because it sort of falls into the larger bucket of just religious accommodation in general, whether it's, in a situation where, like Masterpiece Cake Shop, where, Jack Phillips is selling, doesn't want to design a cake for a same-sex wedding, to a worker who wants to have the Sabbath off and get an accommodation for that. The Supreme Court has strengthened protections for religious accommodations like that. And so I think conscious protections are a way also of providing for religious accommodations. And I think that's something that is going to be given more favorable treatment in the future. So I'm pretty optimistic about that. Not in every state. Some of the states will be holdouts like Oregon, Washington, California, probably New York, those places. But in a lot of states, I think we'll see that kind of thing. And if it doesn't come about through state efforts, it may come about through legal efforts as well. We've had some successes there as well. Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful.
So Leah, being the pessimist that you said you are you an optimist like Steve on this issue?
I am a little more optimistic about this. Yeah. And I guess it's just, well, from looking at the bill in New York that passed the state assembly on specifically physician-assisted suicide, it had a section that said, if this is against your conscience, then you can opt out of participating, which, that's encouraging to see. Not that I liked the rest of the bill, but I was glad to see that that is still a part of it. And I'm sure there will still be attempts to remove language like that if it does end up becoming law. But yeah, I do think there is more accommodation for religious beliefs, like not forcing someone to do what they believe is wrong. So it's just, we do have a society that's very, like we said, individualistic. So everyone's got their own definition of right and wrong. And I've even seen pro-abortion groups argue that it's their religious conviction that they should be able to have abortions. So there's a limit to even these arguments when you're all coming at it from a different worldview and a different standard of truth. So, but no, I'm more encouraged about this than most of the other topics we've talked about.
Well, it's interesting. The bill that's in Oregon that is still in committee, because they can't get to a floor vote, but it's still in committee, on taking away the safeguards for assisted suicide. They have in the bill that a physician must refer if requested for it. And I think that's a conscience violation. We'll see where that goes. I want to thank both of you, but let me close with a scripture. This is the end of Matthew 25. Then they themselves also will answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you? Then he will answer them, saying, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. So I want to thank both of you for advocating for who I consider the vulnerable in our communities today. And your stories are very inspiring to us as healthcare professionals. So keep writing, keep doing what you're doing. And I certainly appreciate the gifting that God has given both of you. So thank you for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Rick. Enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to The Voice of Advocacy. If you would like to suggest a future guest or share a comment with us, please email advocacy@cmda.org. And if you like the podcast, be sure to give us a 5-star rating and share it on your favorite social media platform. This podcast has been a production of Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.